Welcome to the Far and Beyond podcast, hosted by the Contracts and Fiscal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. This podcast is for the federal government attorney navigating the complex intersection of acquisitions in fiscal law and policy. I am your host, Major Ellie Sewell.
And I'm co-hosting Major Hyun Muniz.
On this episode of Far and Beyond, we have two special guests with us, Mr. Adam Cottle and Ms. Christine Kassekert. Thank you so much for joining us today. We're going to be talking about OTAs, or other transaction authorities. So why don't you guys go ahead and introduce yourselves?
Sure. I'm Adam Cottle. I'm with the Department of the Army Office of the General Counsel Acquisition Law Practice Group.
I'm Christine Kassekert. I am an Associate General Counsel at Defense Health Agency. Previously was the Learning Director for Other Transaction Authority at DAU, where I still am an adjunct professor and teach classes. And at DAU, I was also one of the contributors to the current version of the OT guide.
So we have our two experts here, and I, the non-expert, I'm going to give you just a layman overview of how OTA started before we hand it right back to them. So picture this, right? 1958, we got the space race going on with the Soviet Union. We got to keep up. We got to beat them to space. But how? The acquisition plans, the rules that are currently in place, not the most speedy. Now, we're going to get into whether, you know, this alternative or the OTAs we're talking about is really faster than FAR-based acquisitions later on. But initially, when we started, we're trying to find some kind of way to get there faster, right? Beyond the federal acquisition regulations that we had currently in place. What do we do? Something where literally this is how it started, this is when we were naming them, not a contract, but something other than a contract, right? Others. This is literally how they came up with the name. I'm not kidding you in the history. Other. We're going to stick with that other. And so the issue is that other transactions that, you know, the name as it came to be OT kind of created this ambiguity going forward, right? As to what exactly is an OT, what exactly is an other transaction agreement, right? One of you can enlighten us as to exactly what is an OT, what is an OTA?
Well, an OTA is something other than a contract. Do you need any more than that?
I think we do. I think history has shown that we do need a little more than that.
So the authorities that we're talking about today are in 10 U.S.C. 4021 and 10 U.S.C. 4022. We've had research other transaction authority for quite a while. That's the 4021 authority. And if you've been around long enough to think that other transactions are just for research, that's probably because you haven't been involved in the developments of 10 U.S.C. 4022 and prototype other transaction authority, which I think is what we're going to focus on today, because that's been getting a bit more push from the Department of War to use in the past year. The 10 U.S.C. 4021 research authority is subject to the Dodgers, and there is a research OT guide, portions of the Dodgers, not all of the Dodgers, for a point of clarification. The 10 U.S.C. 4022 authority, the statutory in 4022A, is to carry out prototype projects that are directly relevant to enhancing the mission effectiveness of personnel of the Department of Defense, or improving platforms, systems, components, or materials proposed to be acquired or developed by the Department of Defense, or to improvement of platform systems, components, or materials in use by the armed forces. So focus here on the first part of that, carry out prototype projects. We're going to talk in a minute about what a prototype project is, because that is defined in the statute. And then they must be directly relevant to enhancing the mission effectiveness of the personnel of the Department of Defense, among other things. That's incredibly broad. And so we're seeing them used in a broad variety of ways. And then the statute in 4022E5 defines a prototype project to include, and I just want to make note for the attorneys out there, there is a comment in the joint explanatory statement of the FY23 NDAA that said that this definition is not intended to be restrictive. It's a floor, not a ceiling. But if you fall within this definition, you should be good to go. But if you're not within this definition, you should be able to make a reasonable argument whether what you want to do is a prototype project or not. But the statutory definition, once again, incredibly broad. It can be a proof of concept, model, or process, including a business process. Business process is incredibly broad. It can be reverse engineering to address obsolescence, something our logisticians love. A pilot or novel application of commercial technologies for defense purposes. there is a myth that we should not be using other transactions for commercial items, but within the statute, it's talking about piloting or novel applications of commercial technology. So clearly we're allowed to use commercial technologies as the subject of other transaction agreements. It can be anything that incorporates agile development activity. So this is a way that we approach software development is the agile development activity in D of 4022E5. The creation, design, development, or demonstration of operational utility. So you can buy a thing, you can put it out in the field, you can test it and see if it works. And you've got a demonstration of operational utility that would satisfy the definition of a prototype project. And then F is any combination of these subparagraphs. So if you're dealing with 10 U.S.C. 4022, your first starting point as an attorney is to read the statute. It's not terribly long. It's not a terribly difficult statute to understand. So they did give us a bit of a gem with that.
Okay, so we've looked at the statutes. What's next?
So we have an OT guide, and lawyers tend to think that because it's guidance and it's not policy and it's not regulation, hasn't gone through the regulatory process, that we shouldn't be looking at that. So the OT guide has been referenced both in the 2018 Oracle decision by GAO as deferring to what is in the OT guide as interpreting the statute, in addition to recent Court of Federal Claims decisions that have deferred to the OT guide. So attorneys, while appropriately identifying it as not an authority that has gone through notice and comment rulemaking, should not be afraid to rely on the OT guide in understanding how DOD interprets this statute. Mm-hmm. And it has a number of really good ideas and lessons learned of folks who have done this before. The other piece that is out there is we do have a regulation. It's in 32 CFR Part 3. The problem is that that regulation was promulgated under the FY 2016 NDAA, and that was subsequently repealed. So that regulation is there, but it's not particularly helpful to those of us who are in the other transaction world at the moment. The only piece of that remains is the portion that describes the Single Audit Act. And if you're paying attention to the OT guide, you're going to capture that without going back and looking at the regulation.
So I would like to interject in terms of, while we do follow our guidebooks and everything, and this is true of all acquisitions, nobody should ever follow a guidebook blindly. And that's unfortunately a mistake we see sometimes. If someone says, contracting officer, sometimes even an attorney who says, well, I saw this in the guidebook and I followed it. Everyone, agreements officers, by virtue of their warrants, attorneys, by virtue of the license, are nonetheless required to exercise sound business judgment and make sure and say, does this actually work for us in these circumstances? Is this appropriate? Because I can guarantee there is no court in the United States that's going to say, oh, you followed the DODOT guide, that's good enough. And so we got to make sure that we are careful here. And I tell folks, especially involving the Revolutionary Fire Overhaul, that you've got to think a little bit like an administrative law attorney. If you didn't justify, if you didn't write down that justification, you're probably going to lose in court. And if you don't lose in court, when you get to the OTA implementation, you're still going to have problems because guess what? There might be a different agreements officer in the future. There might be a different attorney. They don't know what you did and why you did it if you didn't write it down. So in all things, there should be a very robust written record that explains these are the business decisions we made. This is why we did it. And this is what we were hoping to achieve by this. And that way there's something we can follow along in the future, no matter what the circumstances may be. Maybe a court case, maybe an IG and audit. It may be simply you're trying to implement an OTA 5 years from now, near the end of it, and everyone else has moved on. So you've really got to be careful in making sure that you are not simply following things blindly.
And I would take that a little bit on a different tact as well in terms of the robust documentation. One of the things that we don't have in the OT guide is a similar approach as the Federal Acquisition Regulation that tells you exactly what has to be in your file, which on the one hand gives you some discretion to choose what you're going to document, how you're going to document it. On the other hand, I think one of our lessons learned is other transactions are a team sport. It relies on a number of different subject matter experts to come together and make decisions at different points in time. And just by the natural ebb and flow of what we do, whether we have military service members who are coming in and out of a post, whether we have individuals who are retiring, whether we have people who are getting promoted, whether I get hit by a bus tomorrow. All of those things need to have some ability for some other person to step into that team role and understand where we came from. And so tailoring that documentation to the appropriate risks and scope and concerns of the team so that somebody can step in and take over without losing ground, without creating unnecessary documentation and churn. But I do think that your focus on when did we make a business decision and what were the components of that decision is incredibly important so that we don't go back and misunderstand how we got to where we were. We don't have a set process in other transactions. We create that process. And part of creating a good process is making sure that we have good decision points and that we're moving forward, or we are, if something isn't working, that we know how to go back and identify what wasn't working and documenting that, not necessarily in formal long memos, but having appropriate documentation for what we're working with is very important. And sometimes our subject matter experts are really better than the lawyers at helping us understand what that documentation should look like. But it requires that team to give input and make conscious decisions about how to run these.
Yeah. And along that same line is that we've talked a lot about in other sort of forums about the use of generative AI and this sort of thing. I think there's actually value, but also caution here. Everyone now has access to our Gen AI throughout the Department of War. And while there is certainly danger if we simply throw a prompt and say, come up with a memo that does this thing, there is value. And one of the uses I have found is putting documents into Gen AI and say, tell me where the risks are in this document, help me make it better. So there's certainly a way for our listeners to use these new tools that we've been given to improve the quality of these documents rapidly at a minimum burden to themselves by saying, hey, I already have this basic document, Gen AI. What risks do you see in it? Help me make it a better quality document to address those risks, and thereby, without creating an undue administrative burden, reduce the overall risk in the government so we can still go fast.
Speaking of fast, you're saying that we're going to use AI to try to streamline OTAs, but I think just based on its origin, people may think that OTs are just in nature faster than FAR-based acquisitions. Is that a myth, or do you see that this is going to be, OTs are going to be utilized more because we're trying to streamline acquisitions now?
So I think it's absolutely a myth. OTAs, there's nothing in there that makes them inherently faster than a FAR-based contract. We can award under different authorities. We can award FAR-based contracts from the word go to award within days. We have awarded, for example, a PO soldier of 18 months. About 18 months ago, I was involved in action between the acquisition decision memorandum that authorized the start of the program to contract award. It was a $1 billion contract in 87 days. So there's absolutely no evidence that OTAs are inherently faster than FAR-based contracts. They are a different tool for different circumstances because there are certain vendors that are unwilling to address and to work within the certain regulatory schemes of the FAR. For example, the Army for many years had an OTA with Microsoft. Microsoft with the IVAS contract and, well, it's an agreement, not a contract, but the IVAS program. And so Microsoft was simply unwilling to enter into a FAR-based contract with that. And there were pros and cons to that approach. And ultimately, Microsoft decided to bow out entirely and did an innovation to Anduril and Palmer Luckey, and they took over that program because Microsoft, even with the OTA, wasn't willing to follow the government's requirements for what we wanted to get. And so there were a number of issues with that. But that's really what OTAs are about, is not just trying to go a little bit faster, but trying to be able to tailor to contractors who say, look, yeah, government, I recognize you have something that I want, but I'm not willing to play by your acquisition rules. For whatever reason, I'm not going to judge them for that. They have their opinions, they're entitled to them. And this is another tool in our toolbox to say, hey, these folks who are not willing to engage on us on that, we still need that innovative technology. We still need that new thing. And so we're willing to be flexible ourselves. And so it's recognizing that distinction there. There are other ones who say, I'm totally willing to play by FAR, and we'll go down that route. And there are pros and cons of both, but it is absolutely a myth that OTAs are inherently faster or somehow better than a FAR-based contract.
Well, Adam, you touched a little bit on why we use other transaction agreements. I think the biggest benefit to the government is the iterative process, the back and forth that we can insert. So we get to describe, we get to define how we want to run our competitive procedure to the maximum extent practical, which is our statutory requirement with another transaction agreement. We're not under the Competition and Contracting Act. We're not under the source selection guide when we're doing prototype other transactions awards. And so that iterative process that I start with a problem statement, I describe my problem, and then I go out ask industry to come tell me how they would address it. Typically in the OT process, you start with white papers or demonstrations, whatever it makes sense for what it is you're trying to buy, and whether it exists now and you need to modify it, or whether you're starting from scratch and trying to incentivize a group of companies to come together to solve our problem. We adapt the process to what we're seeing in terms of how we need to solve the problem. And then after we get their initial approaches and we decide who we think makes the most sense to move forward with, we sit in a room and we write the statement of work together. We don't get a proposal as we do on a Competition and Contracting Act based award that we just pick the winner and fund it. That ability to sit in a room, have the engineers talk to the engineers, have the security people talk to the security people, have the logisticians talk to the folks who are going to be designing so they can figure out that lifecycle support early on is, in my experience, the biggest benefit that other transactions give us, because we're not experts in every portion of what we're buying, but we have smart people who, when they start asking questions and engaging, can make very good decisions on our behalf. And that is that iterative process is a huge bonus to us. If your focus is on speed, hurry up and make the prototype award. You may undermine what I think is the biggest benefit of what this gets us, because people don't have time to go through the process of what they need to design or understanding the risks associated with what we're going forward with. And so you can design a much faster process with an OT. That is 100% true. But if you're using it to get what we need, especially if we're trying to solve problems, you can either have a process that doesn't give you the best prototype award, or the other thing that we see is you rush through the prototyping, right? Somebody is saying, we used an OT for speed. My deadline is Friday. Get this award done. Okay, so I made a prototype award, or I made a decision during prototyping, but I don't really have everything I need to move forward. And so speed can undermine the quality of what we're trying to do, or it can put us in a non-competitive situation that we move forward with someone because we only have time to deal with one. And then on the back end, we have problems negotiating terms. And so the prototype award speed is easier to get to, because generally when we're prototyping, it's easier to get to terms and conditions with prototyping, especially as we modify that prototype and change it. And everybody is kind of on the same page for most of our prototypes. Like, hey, we're all trying to get to the cool toy, mm-hmm. the cool thing that we're going to have at the end of the prototyping. But when we then have a successful prototype and try to go to follow-on production, if we did not lay the groundwork for a successful follow-on production award, those negotiations can stall. And we've seen them stall for a year or two. So you may be much smarter putting the time into a little bit of a slower and deliberative process up front to get what you want at the end. Part of an OT gets us out of the federal acquisition regulation and the constraints of a very set process. So we should be mindful of how we're modifying this process and using that prudent business judgment standard to modifying it appropriately.
Now, one other advantage of OTs, though, is that in a FAR-based contract world, you can't have contractors talk to each other. Each contractor, you have to treat them separately. One of the kind of fun things to do, and that can be very advantageous to the Department of War in an OT, is that if one contractor has a 75% solution and the other one has the remaining 25%, we can say, hey guys, we really think you should talk to each other because each one of you has something that would add value and make a better product. That will take more time because they have to go out there and negotiate a business relationship. And we have to say, hey guys, we're going to put a pause on this for a month or so while you do this. But again, going to Christine's point, that produces a better outcome for the Department of War at the end of the day, because instead of having each one of them independently develop a prototype, we can have them collaborate and work together to develop an overall better quality one from the very beginning. Now, part of what Christine goes through, though, is that this whole issue of requirement, what do we actually need? And that's something we've seen over and over again. There is no amount of OTA relaxation of the rules that's going to change that. If you don't know what you need at the beginning, it's going to be bad at the end. And so we sometimes have these very vague problem statements of, oh, give me a solution that kind of addresses this issue. And we haven't taken the time to really drill down and say, what is the actual root cause problem that we are trying to address here? And we see that through requirements creep of, in Firebase and OTA contracts alike, where we'll start with one thing and we get to the end and we say, oh, this looks very different because we realized the process, this was a different problem we were trying to solve. And we wasted all this time and money and the product's now not really what we actually can use, or it's too expensive and we have to start all over. So there are lots of pitfalls if we haven't taken the time to think through everything before we really get started.
I think if you're advising programs as well, we understand where the decision points are in FAR-based contracting, and most of our oversight when our project leaders are coming in and getting approvals from their senior leaders and when the funding is going to become available, when the solicitation hits the street, when the source selection team makes a recommendation, if you have an SSAC, and then finally, you know, what the final decision looks like in the award. We know in a FAR-based process, built in, what people should be asking and what those approvals look like. If you're in another transaction world, just as Adam said, I have decision points. For example, I'm talking to two performers and I'm considering whether they should continue prototyping separately or whether we should, I'm going to say, suggest or recommend that those companies work together. Because I think one pitfall that the government needs to be careful of is it is a rare circumstance that we should be telling companies that they should be working together in a way that makes the decision for them. We simply don't know the dynamics of these companies. So making recommendations or suggestions or telling them what we're seeing in their proposals, that is why we think that they may want to go talk to each other and have a good fit. All of that is allowed under another transaction. It is not untoward. It is not unethical. It is not a problem. We don't have CICA. So we have the flexibility to do this. And it's a great tool in that iterative process as we figure it out. Cautionary note that we need to be very careful about telling who in industry needs to work with who. That can go too far. We need to be careful about business judgment. But think about the impact of how that decision plays out. If I took my two strongest performers and tell them to go work together, did I ultimately get rid of a competitive market in what I'm doing? That's not a cautionary tale to not do that. It's an example of, as I am making decisions in the strategy for the way that my prototyping project is working out, what should my senior leaders be advising on? Because if all I do is come back to them when I'm ready to go to follow-on production, which I think is the tendency if you're used to using FAR-based awards, now you've lost the ability to get the input of your senior leadership or some other subject matters or some folks who may have a bigger picture view of how this is going to play out over time. Mm-hmm. And back to the OTs or a team sport, that can be critical in our long-term success of what we're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, and if I could throw in one more consideration as we go back and forth on this, is one of the goals that we often don't think about is what is this going to do to the defense industrial base as a whole? That's something that's actually very critical in this administration's mind, is expanding and mobilizing the defense industrial base. We've talked about 2027 in previous podcasts. We've talked about the threats posed by China, the quantities that they are producing, and we've talked about the atrophied state of the American defense industrial base. It is small. It is much smaller than we would like it to be. And so as we go through and we deal with these competition concerns, one of the things we must be mindful of is not just producing a quality product, but when we get to production, which we're going to get to in a few minutes, what impact would, for example, suggesting two vendors that they work together, what impact will that have on the defense industrial base? Am I actually going to decrease the industrial base in some way? Because at the end of the day, we have to produce far more than we currently are. Secretary Driscoll has talked about his goal of producing the U.S. Army alone, just the Army, buying 1 million drones a year starting in 2028, which is far beyond the current capacity of the defense industrial base. So we do absolutely have to be mindful as we're going through this process of not just our short-term goals, but our longer-term goals of what are we trying to do? Because it's not just about this immediate prototype. It's making sure that we have enough companies who are manufacturing American-made products to support us and to provide for our needs on things like unmanned aerial systems and produce the massive quantities that we will need to successfully fight a war against an adversary like China.
Yeah. And you have the big picture view on that. In my world, I'm like why are we not infusing competition every place we can, right? So even if you're not thinking about the impact on the defense industrial base, I'm prototyping. It is a lot easier for me to negotiate prototype terms and conditions and pricing if I'm in a competitive environment. It is a lot easier for me over time, after I've made a follow-on production award, to have companies be more willing to modify those awards to increase whether it's quantities or provide supplementary services to support the prototypes if I remain in a competitive environment. And so all of these things are things that fall back into that prudent business judgment standard, that we want to remain in a competitive environment with the prototyping and with the follow-on production as long as we can. And then, yeah, we should absolutely be taking into consideration some of these big picture issues. But if you heard drones and said, I'm not buying drones, or you are not doing the big picture things that are really going to impact the defense industrial base, it's absolutely appropriate to also think, how do I make this process work for me? And it is almost never working for you if you find yourself negotiating pricing on a sole source basis in another transaction.
And this is why you don't let Christine and I go at it, because we talk forever about these things.
No, this is great.
This is actually wonderful because I love everything you guys are saying. It's just blowing my mind, right? And it's just, I think the question I was having while you guys were talking is, because everything you're describing, the way that industry engages and how everyone comes together and tries to tackle solution, or you're trying to make a judgment between whether you should let two of your best people compete instead of working together, all that, it's so radically different from how the FAR works, right? And this rigid procedural process of it all. And what I'm grasping here is, then if it's outside the FAR, which, by the way, when I think of that, I think about the Little Caesars pizza commercial back then, you know, then there are no rules. And the guy's like taking his shirt off. That is literally how I think of the OT. And I am not alone, by the way. I know I'm not alone. I want to at least address that, because it's what OTs feel like to me. There are no rules. But is the rule then just that your own business judgment? Is that the constraints of it? I mean, where's the boundary, right?
Well, the Procurement Integrity Act is absolutely one boundary.
Okay. Right.
Full stop.
Fair.
Procurement Integrity Act. I don't
Still
know
there.
That it would stop the Little Caesars pizza guy from taking his shirt off, but it certainly puts some constraints on what could be bad behavior that is detrimental to what we do. So the advice that I have always had for folks is the same in briefing that we do for a source selection team with our FAR-based awards. We do a similar one with our other transaction evaluators, right? Because it's still the Procurement Integrity Act, fully tailored. But in terms of, you know, applicable things that would really tie your hands on what you can do, you cannot listen to one pitch from a company and then turn around and go into the next pitch and say, hey, that guy said this. What are you going to do about that?
Mm-hmm.
Full stop. No,
yeah.
Not happening.
Now, there are other rules as well. And the Department of War OTA guide goes through a number of them. One of them, I'd have to point out, it's the mandatory. The Anti-Deficiency Act still applies even to OTAs. And unfortunately, we've had people who try to argue, well, this is an OTA. Money, color money doesn't matter.
There are no rules, remember?
Right, exactly. And that's the myth, is that, no, there are rules, just the FAR doesn't apply. And that actually gets into something that has been an area of concern I've seen in multiple cases, which is people say, well, there are no rules, but I'm uncomfortable simply starting from nothing, so I'm going to borrow from the FAR. And that can have pros and cons. It's comfortable for us. It's that old pair of blue jeans, the old t-shirt you pull on. It fits just right. You're like, I understand this. I can work with this. I can move around. I'm flexible. Okay, we understand that. But there are some real pitfalls. One is sometimes we import restrictions unnecessarily into an OTA from the FAR. For example, we may talk about commercial data rights and non-commercial data rights in the same OTA. Why are we doing that? Because at the end of the day, commercial data rights are far more restrictive than government purpose rights. And so which itself isn't even necessarily a term that we have to use in an OTA. And even, for example, if you use the term government purpose rights in an OTA, if that goes to court for any reason, because there's a dispute later on, the court is most likely, we've seen this all the cases so far, but I can't guarantee every court, the court is going to say, yeah, this term means something in the FAR context, we're not in a FAR context, and they will interpret it in whatever way they feel like. And so simply assuming that because we've brought a FAR clause into the OTA, if you do not define all those individual little terms there, the court is going to interpret them however it feels, and you can be in a completely different spot. And you're like, but I intended it to be this way. Did you put that within the four corners of the document? No, you did not. And that's when the big challenge is with OTAs is we make assumptions because in the FAR, if I say a commercial, something's a commercial product, that has a specific term and meaning. If I say the word shall, shall in the FAR is defined as must and is defined as an imperative. I can go to the FAR 2.102 and I can go look that up and that's what it says. Shall in an OTA context might be permissive. And so we really have to think about what do these words mean outside of the FAR. And that's the one assumption we make that's unfortunately often faulty. The other one that I've seen people do is that they'll say, okay, I'll just use this FAR clause. If you reference something in the FAR clause back to another part of the FAR, and the FAR is fairly integrated and has a lot of references to the FAR parts, you may wind up on this very wild chain that goes throughout half the FAR, and you wind up saying, oh, I somehow incorporated by reference, you know, half of the FAR, and I wasn't supposed to do that. So practitioners should be very careful about simply importing things from the FAR because they're comfortable. It's a good starting point, but they should always be tailored to the individual needs of the OTA. And of course, always scrub to make sure you're not incorporating something by reference you don't want to. And then also making sure that you are defining all the key terms. And sometimes terms are like, how is this possibly key terms such as shall? You need to define those clearly what it is you want to get. And especially with intellectual property. And we've seen this a few times as well, where we start off with IP one way in the prototype. We go to a follow-on production award, that's an OTA. We go to a FAR-based contract, and all of a sudden, what we thought we were getting in the FAR-based contract, the data rights are completely different because of the prototyping OTA. We failed to negotiate the actual data rights we wanted. So we have to do a lot of thinking through this, and lawyers have to be very careful of what exactly we're saying in these agreements.
Two thoughts on what you just said, Adam. So absolutely, the Anti-Deficiency Act applies. One little known piece is that the advance payment prohibition does not apply for other transaction awards. And part of this comes out of the history of we used to have 10 U.S.C. 2371 for our research OTs, and 2371B was for our prototype OTs. Subsequently, those statutes changed. But DOD's position has always been that the prototype OTs were kind of under the research OTs for purposes of the advance payment. And the OT guide makes it clear that the advance payment prohibition does not apply to prototype OTs. So especially if you're doing agile software development, this becomes a much easier item to manage than under a FAR-based award, trying to not run afoul of some of these items. And, you know, oftentimes we recommend that people use the FAR as a checklist. You know, did you cover all of these kinds of things, even if you're not inserting the FAR clauses? But there are a couple of FAR clauses that the guidance specifically says should be used as FAR clauses. One of them is SAM.gov. One of them has to do with government furnished property because FPASA applies not only to FAR-based awards, but to OTs. There are a couple of FAR clauses that we do put in word for word, and just don't want any confusion out there that that's a sign that we should just flat out be using FAR clauses for everything. Just because we have a couple of things that are, you know, standard language that happen to be in the FAR. I also want to clarify, just because we say the FAR does not apply to other transactions does not mean that nothing in the FAR will apply to an other transaction. There are certain regulations that come from statutes that are specific to procurement contracts. Those portions of the Federal Acquisition Regulation will not apply to prototype other transactions or follow-on production transactions. When we get to follow-on production, we have the option to make a follow-on production award as an OT or as a contract. Those FAR provisions, clauses, terms will apply to a follow-on production contract. And when we say that the FAR doesn't apply to OTs, we don't mean that they do not apply to a follow-on production contract. But many of the portions of the FAR address, for example, government furnished property. How the government is responsible for tracking its property is not specific to a procurement contract. And so there are portions of the FAR, your cybersecurity rules, your prohibitions on things that we can buy from China, those apply in many cases, broadly, no matter whether we're talking about grants or cooperative agreements or procurement contracts. And so those items are going to come in and apply to another transaction as well. And so just want to put a clarifying distinction out there. When we say the FAR doesn't apply, it would be too far to say that just because it's in the FAR, it's never going to apply to another transaction.
Correct. Another good example is the Federal Debt Collection Act and FAR Part 32. And it's the reason we actually have Federal Contracting Officer final decisions and demand letters. That also applies regardless of what kind of procurement instrument we are using. So yeah, there's practitioners need to be aware of and make sure they do their homework and check the originating statute and say, hey, where does this actually, what does this actually apply to? And is it restricted simply to the FAR or is it everything that we do? So yeah, you're absolutely 100% correct on that.
That covers the foundation of other transactions, but there's a whole second layer to this involving protests and risks that we need to get into. To keep things digestible, I'm splitting this into two episodes. Join us next week on the second half of our OT discussion. Thank you for joining us today in this episode of FAR and Beyond. Please make sure to follow us and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. We love to hear from our listeners. Please continue to reach out to us on Facebook and LinkedIn. The information can be found in the show notes from today's episode. The views expressed today are those of the presenters, not that of the Judge Advocate General Corps, the Department of the Army, the Department of the Air Force, the Defense Health Agency, or the Department of War.